back together again, you and I, for a brand new week and a brand new month on Monday, October 2nd, 2023. With Connecticut Today, we highlighted a high-profile case involving a gruesome murder from years ago. Opinion columnist and blogger Chris Powell stopped by for his monthly update, and Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield talked about a DOT pop-up meeting concerning possible rate hikes and service cuts for train and bus service into and through Fairfield County. So I checked, I ended up checking, and unfortunately, nothing major has changed since I sat behind this microphone 2 weeks ago as far as whether or not we are losing our collective minds, right? Whether or not we're just, whether or not we really have enough as a whole, as a cumulative society, whether or not we have enough of the two things you need to be a living individual, blood circulation and oxygen. Because apparently we don't. Hi, how are you? Coming back here, I figured let's start Paulie back in the afternoon here with another chapter of We're Losing Our Collective Minds. How about we do that here? I have a lot of stuff coming on later in the show. I just got my new printout from the state as to what I would be paying with a mileage tax. So I've been updating you on that. We'll go with that. But why don't we start out with a few stories that will let you know that just when you think society might be trying to straighten itself out, it's not. Can we do that? Is that possible? How about this? Did you read about this story last week? And you'll see how this all ties together. Did you see this story last week? And I wasn't able to talk about it because I was happily filling in for Melissa in the morning, Monday through Friday, 5 to 10, right here on WICC. There was a man who killed a relatively young tech entrepreneur. Her name was Pava LaPere, or LaPere, excuse me. I'm not sure the name, with all due respect. God rest her soul. She was a Baltimore tech entrepreneur. He killed her a few days ago. They finally found this dirtbag and put him back in his cage. I'm sorry, alleged dirtbag, and put him back in his cage. And now they're saying that she actually let him into the building. So they're trying to picture how he got into this building in Baltimore, which was a high-end building where a lot of rich people lived. Although Baltimore, if you do any research, is descending into rat hole status. Now, again, this is what I mean. When I mean you read this stuff and you say that the crazies are running us. All you have to do is get down to, this is an Associated Press story. You just have to go down to the second paragraph. And your crazy alarm should go off. Jason Billingsley, who was charged with first-degree murder in LaPere's death, was released from prison last October after serving a shortened sentence for a 2013 rape because he earned good behavior credits behind bars. Please explain to me, and I'm open for your calls here. Come on in. The water's fine. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. In what breathing or functioning society do the terms rape conviction and good behavior go together? Can anybody answer that? The guy who allegedly killed this young tech entrepreneur, and you found out in the investigation and the publicity about this last week that she was a real rising star. If you knew her field, she was a front-of-mind person. This guy, Jason Billingsley, was released from prison last October after serving a shortened sentence for a 2013 rape because he got good behavior credits behind bars. Of course he got good behavior credits beyond bars because he's sick. He's nuts. He's an animal. He's a predator. Ask any psychiatric professional you want, and they will tell you some of the most violent, vile, animalistic people can act quasi-normal or normally behind bars if they know it'll get them back out hunting sooner. But yet, I guess the morons, the idiots who run our criminal justice system in many areas, including in blue-leaning states, I guess they don't get this. So this guy got a shortened sentence for a 2013 rape because they let him out because he had good behavior credits. Isn't that great? Isn't that great? By the way, according to the Associated Press, he's also charged with 24 counts in a September 19th rape in which a woman and a man were bound with duct tape before being set on fire. Police had been actively searching for him since then. Now, this guy, if these allegations are all true, deserves a high-caliber slug right between his eyes. But we won't do that. We'll put him back in jail and we'll say, hey, maybe he'll get good behavior credits. Are you a little upset at what I'm saying here? Well, you should be. Well, you should be. During a bail review hearing in Baltimore District Court, the judge saying she considered Billingsley's criminal history and the fact that he's facing multiple violent crime and sexual offense charges. Finally, thank you, Your Honor. Thanks. But again, the morons that work in the Maryland and the Baltimore judicial system said, hey, let's let this guy out. We know he raped somebody in 2013, but he earned good behavior credits. Folks, it's mind-numbing. I mean, how is this allowed to happen? I mean, again, we talk about victims' rights, victims' advocacy, believing all women. Well, you know what? To me, victim rights or victims' rights 1, 1A and 1B are keeping some of these animals in jail when there's no there's no doubt that their behavior has changed. I mean, come on. I'm no psychiatric professional. Honestly, I just say there is a pudgy, suburban, white Italian guy who sits there and says, wait a minute. This guy raped someone. He raped someone, and he gets good behavior credits. Now, if you think that's bad, how about this? Again, I'm reverting to my 2 a.m. in the morning, you're up watching because you can't sleep infomercials. How about this? We go from Baltimore to the beautiful Park City, Connecticut Post, Hearst Media, Dan Teffer. Bridgeport man who killed and ate another man is released after spending 10 years in a psychiatric hospital. A state board has ordered the release of a former Florida man who officials say killed a homeless man and then ate his brain and his eyeballs. I'm sorry if I have to say that, but it's in the paper. Tyree Smith, who grew up in Bridgeport and Ansonia, was found not guilty of murder by reason of insanity following a July 2013 trial and ordered committed to state psychiatric hospital for 60 years. So you're saying to yourself, all right, 60 years, plus 2013, so that would be 2017. 2073. But wait a minute. Hold it. Ha ha ha. Silly you. But wait a minute, Paul. What are you talking about? He was convicted in 2013, 10 years ago, and sentenced in a psych ward for 60 years. You're saying to yourself, yeah, the guy's criminally insane. Most people are who eat other human beings. I don't know about you, but cannibalism, yeah, it's kind of, it's not really in vogue anymore. But this week, the State Psychiatric Security Review Board ruled that Smith, after spending 10 years in the state's most secure psychiatric hospital, is ready to be transitioned into the community. He has since been released and will be living in a Waterbury group home. Hello, Waterbury. Are you listening? Hello? Waterbury. Waterbury Base Camp. Come in, Waterbury. Do you read me? He has since been released and will be living in a Waterbury group home, according to the report. He is... They told him, you're not to associate with anyone involved in criminal activity. Dear God. Dear sweet Jesus. Some guy gets paroled for a rape in Baltimore because of good behavior, and he kills a woman. And we have a guy in this area who killed someone and consumed part of his body. Originally, they said, that's it, 60 years in a nut house. But guess what? A psychiatric security review board said that after just spending 10 years, he's ready to be transitioned into the community. We are, folks, I'm telling you, we are losing our collective minds. And the vast majority of people sit around drooling, going, All right, back to the insanity momentarily. When we do that, it'll be a 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Time for our monthly check-in with thought leader, opinion leader, columnist, blogger Chris Powell. Check him out, the Chris Powell Column. It's at chrispowellcolumn.com. Spell it out, all one word. Attach it, chrispowellcolumn.com. And Mr. Powell, good afternoon, sir. We meet again. How are you?
I'm good, but I never impersonated a thought leader, as well, far as I know.
Well, wait a minute. Your handler told me before we came on to make sure I do that. So
you know where he is? He owes me money.
Yes, yes. I saw him driving away in a nice late-model German sedan, so we'll have to talk about that. Chris, in your latest, or one of your latest columns, again, we celebrated, Mr. Powell, the raising of the state's minimum wage again, but it seems to be just a continuing bandage on a wound here.
Yeah, I don't think it's anything to celebrate, Paul. Just because it's a response to uncontrolled inflation. The minimum wage is going to go up about 4.5% on January 1st, but inflation has been running at least that high for a couple of years, probably higher. I don't trust the government figure. There's a lot of evidence that the government keeps changing the criteria for measuring inflation, so it underestimates the real inflation. But this is not going to get anybody any gains in life. Anybody on minimum wage who's going to get this 4.5% raise in January, he's not even going to be keeping up with inflation. I think it'd be, you know, far more productive and interesting if the governor, our legislators, would try to address where inflation comes from. It's not just a force of nature. It's not the weather. It's a it's a result of government economic policy. And if they have to keep raising the minimum wage to keep up with inflation, well, why don't we just stop inflation?
Yeah, and I remember, Chris, and I think you do too, in the middle of COVID, and people were saying, pump out money there, pump out. And, you know, we had the first stimulus, I think, under Mr. Trump, and people said, well, that was okay. The second stimulus, people were like, eh. And I remember the third one, and one guy who really spoke up about this, Chris, if you remember, was hardly a conservative, Larry Summers, a former Clinton, I think, Treasury Secretary, and affiliated with Harvard. And I remember Summers was among the guys and gals who said, don't do this because this is really going to trigger a lot of inflation. They brushed him off. And now look what happened.
Yeah, well, you know, it's only logical. I mean, here we have the epidemic and government is telling so many people to stay home, preventing them from working. And then keep sending out all this money to people. Well, what happens? You know, production has stopped, but the money in the economy floating around has increased. And when people go on Amazon to order stuff, they find the price is going up because nobody's making any goods, or not nobody, but production had certainly declined sharply, even as the money supply was soaring. Well, that's the prescription for inflation, and that's what the government's epidemic policy gave us. It was very, very mistaken, if you ask me, to tell people that they couldn't work.
Chris Powell is the guest. And, Chris, now we're seeing that translate into almost election year politics. We're about a year out where, you know, you have about half the country saying, hey, look how great the economy is. We're bouncing back. And, Chris, millions of people saying, hey, look, I don't necessarily love Trump, but why am I paying $3.85 for gas continuously? Why is my restaurant bill tipping $100 now and I'm dropping, you know, $40, $50, $60 a shot of the grocery store and walking out with one bag? I really think, Chris, that there's a real disconnect on this stuff, and not to mention interest rates as well.
Yeah, the polls suggest, Paul, that the country is very, very unhappy economically, that living standards are declining. And nevertheless, President Biden is emphasizing this aspect of his administration, and it's not selling. And I think it's a big risk when you tell people to deny the evidence of their own eyes, to believe you and not what they're seeing in their daily lives. The economy is weak, and many economists are expecting a recession, in large part because of the rising interest rates. I mean, the housing market is shutting down because there's little construction, and mortgage rates are soaring. The economy is not good, and Biden thinks that if he runs on it, he can persuade people that what they encounter in their daily lives really isn't true.
The guest is Chris Powell. Once again, you can check out all of his writings at chrispowellcolumn.com. Chris, your one coming out tomorrow, it deals with a couple of actually pretty high-profile court decisions and awards here, not necessarily court cases, well, at least in one, but awards here that kind of raise eyebrows, even though they're not close in money comparison.
Yeah, there was a settlement the other day in the lawsuit that was brought by the former state health commissioner, Renee Coleman Mitchell, against Governor Lamont. The governor fired her a couple months into the virus epidemic, and she sued him, charging that her firing was racist and sexist and ageist. Now, the lawsuit was ridiculous because, unlike most people in state government, commissioners serve entirely at the pleasure of mm-hmm. the governor.
Yep.
That's the only criteria for being a commissioner is you've got to have the confidence of the governor. Well, Coleman Mitchell lost the confidence of the governor and he fired her. Whereupon she accused him of racism and sexism and ageism, which hardly made sense. If Lamont, the most politically correct governor we've ever had in Connecticut, was racist and sexist and ageist, why did he appoint her in the first place, a black woman? I mean, that doesn't make sense. He wasn't ageist and racist and sexist when he appointed her, but he's racist and sexist and ageist now. The governor does not seem to have wanted to contest the issue. He arranged a settlement with Coleman Mitchell where the state's going to pay her $200,000 and change her employment record to say that she resigned instead of being fired, and she'll be paid this small fortune to go away. But I'm a little surprised that news organizations are not paying more attention to this case. It really was ridiculous, but it showed that if you call somebody racist, hey, that's a big advantage. You're going to win because nobody wants to rebut an accusation of racism. It reminds me what the columnist Charles Krauthammer, who died a few years ago, was probably the best newspaper columnist of his time. He said something like that: we will know in this country when racism is over, not just when you can hire people regardless of their race, but when you can fire them regardless of their race as well. And I think the Coleman Mitchell case shows we're not there yet. The governor was too timid to rebut the accusations of racism.
And Chris, finally, we have that large settlement regarding two gentlemen and the involvement of Dr. Henry Lee here, who I guess one time, Chris, was praised as the god of forensics, but now is there doubt on that? What do you think?
Well, there is some doubt on it. I'm not sure Lee's being criticized fairly in this case, but this was a really horrible murder of a guy in New Milford in 1985. The police arrested and the prosecutors got a conviction of these two guys. They were basically teenage burglars living out of a car, but there was absolutely no forensic evidence linking them to the murder. There wasn't their blood discovered at the murder scene, though the blood was everywhere there, and there wasn't any blood on them. Lee has been in this controversy here because at one point in the proceedings, he testified that he found blood on a towel in the bathroom of the house. That later turned out it wasn't blood at all. But in any case, the blood, if whatever it was not linked to the defendants in the case. I don't see how the jury considered it much in the way of evidence. In fact, the point of my writing about the case was there's an increasing number, it seems, of wrongful convictions in Connecticut. The convictions of these two guys in the New Milford case has just been overturned after they served 30 years in prison, and the settlement with them from the state is they're going to split $25 million between them. But we're full of in Connecticut of these wrongful conviction cases being overturned. And I've been following these for a long time. I was much involved in the Peter Riley case 50 years ago and the Richard LaPointe case 30 years ago, which turned out to be wrongful conviction cases. And I think the real problem here, which is not being examined, is the juries impose these guilty verdicts on without sufficient evidence. I don't think juries in Connecticut understand what the reasonable doubt standard is supposed to be. The old joke has been that you can get prosecutors can get a jury to indict a ham sandwich. And now to me it's seeming you can get a jury in Connecticut to convict a ham sandwich.
Yeah, and Chris, it calls to mind, and I don't know who said it, but we've heard this over the years from somebody who was really smart at one time. What's the old phrase, Chris? It's better to allow a guilty man to go free than to jail an innocent man or an innocent person. And I guess that's
there was an old French philosopher a few hundred years ago, and your memory's better than mine.
Yeah. Chris Powell, thank you. ChrisPowellColumn.com. Read his new column tomorrow, the one that came out over the weekend, and the others as well. Chris, take care. We'll talk next month. Thank you, sir.
Thank much, Paul.
Appreciate it. ChrisPowellColumn.com. And one time, Chris was the managing editor and top columnist at a heck of a newspaper, the Manchester Journal Enquirer, the JI of Manchester, that was recently taken over by the Hearst conglomerate. So, again, there's still these great newspapers in the state. And Chris is, you know, one of those guys, as you hear him in his appearances on my show and other shows around the state, you know, he doesn't pull punches. And, you know, sometimes that limits who picks up his columns or not. But, listen, you may disagree with Chris on a philosophical basis, but at least as you hear by the times he's on this show and others, he puts facts out there to back up his statements. All right, open phones later on in the hour to pack this whole thing away as we're back with you on a Monday at 203-333-9422-333-WICC. You folks in Fairfield County, well, you may not be getting enough of a chance here to make your voices heard to state officials regarding fares, pricing, and scheduling on bus and train service. And to talk about that right now, Fairfield Republican State Senator Tony Wong joins us with a concern that he has. Hey, Tony, how are you?
I am good. And Paul, indeed, I'm very concerned. Our commuters are an integral part of commuters and economic engine of our southwestern Connecticut, and they're a captive audience. And the proposed fare increase combined with reduction of number of trains seems to be absolutely inconsistent with our overall administration philosophy of getting cars off the road, reducing air pollution. I just heard on your broadcast that from Greenwich all the way up to Fairfield and Bridgeport is a one-hour delay. You know, it really is something that is critically important for the quality of life and economics of our community down here, that rail lines need to be fully operational, efficient, and to be fairly priced. But we're not going to get a chance to offer that viewpoint.
Yes. So now, Tony, you have asked for, from what I understand, an official public hearing from a legislative sense on this. But I see in your statement here there's a pop-up meeting. It sounds like something you rent for a kid's party. Hey, let's have a pop-up meeting. There's a pop-up meeting coming up this Thursday, 3:30 to 7 at the Stamford train station. So outline this for my listeners, Tony. What did you want, and what's the DOT actually going to do?
Well, a pop-up meeting, exactly what it feels like, is we're doing you a favor. You know, after all, it seemed like a reasonable request that the volume of commuters and the utilization is down in southwestern Connecticut. Now, these fare changes and schedule changes were a reflection of utilization decline that occurred during COVID. And there was a budgetary process that said you need to make some adjustments. I understand changes need to occur, but the fact is you need to listen to the commuters who are a captive audience and get their perspective. But instead, we're going to have two formal public hearings, one in New Haven, and the other one's going to be up in Hartford. Now, don't get me wrong. Hartford Line, Shoreline East, and all of our commuting communities deserve an opportunity to succeed and thrive. But to not have one in Fairfield County after making explicit asks, when the budget was passed and this was being promoted and brought up, 3+ months ago, I asked to have a meeting down in Fairfield County for the captive audiences to voice their frustrations and concerns. And when it was announced that these meetings were happening today in New Haven, tomorrow in Hartford, and two virtual hearings on Wednesday, I wrote a formal letter about 10 days ago and asking, why was there not a meeting down in Fairfield County? In Stamford, in Norwalk, in Fairfield, in Bridgeport, and nothing. And I requested to have a meeting with the commissioner, and I really implored him. I said, look, if you don't do this, it will reaffirm that these kind of changes are already decided and that you really don't want to hear from the commuters, don't you?
Well, yeah, Tony, it sounds to me
that's where the pop-up has occurred.
Yeah, it sounds to me that they don't want to, you know, stay in the kitchen if it gets a little hot there. I mean, how could you not eschew a large formal gathering in Fairfield County where, listen, I don't know the numbers, Tony, but I rode Metro North, you know, enough times over several years pre-COVID. I mean, that's the bread and butter of the income flow for Metro North is in Fairfield County, at least on the New Haven line.
Without a doubt. And we're not even talking about the devastation to Shoreline East and the reduction of bus services. But to not have a voice really reiterates the frustration that people have as a captive audience for a critical element of their quality of life and economics. It just seems to be so doggone disappointing.
Yeah.
Now, the other part of it is really for an administration, and it goes up to the governor's office in this because the commissioner serves at the leisure of the governor and his vision. For a governor that has talked about getting cars off the road, reducing air emission with his electric vehicle and carbon reduction initiatives, in reducing schedules and raising fares, you're really doing the counter.
Mm-hmm.
You're putting more people onto the road and congesting traffic and air pollution. It seems to be wholly inconsistent with the philosophy of reducing carbon emissions and supporting mass transit. I think the other frustration that I see from any other person looking at it, not only are you reducing schedule, but you're raising fares. The other thing is, what's stunning to me is, we then announced a couple of weeks ago that we're going to spend millions of dollars in buying new rail cars. That money could have been used to create greater efficiency, more trains, reducing fares to the consumer. But instead, we're going to buy cars for the Hartford line. Again, it seems to be disjointed and inconsistent with a broader message that you're articulating. And for those people that are sitting in traffic listening to you, they could have taken the train if there was a more viable and consistent option. But unfortunately, we haven't delivered on that, and it seems like we still haven't delivered on it, but they don't even want to hear from you.
Interesting. All right, so this is this coming Thursday, October 5th, 3:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. Again, not an official public hearing, but a pop-up meeting. And, Tony, do you have any idea who will be there? Will the commissioner be there? Will there be any of his minions there? Who will actually be there? Do we know?
I will share with you, and this is really an important part. I have great respect and a very good working relationship with the commissioner and the DOT. But it seems like that the administration and some of the bureaucracies are inconsistent with the mission of what they're trying to articulate. So there's some really good people that really made an earnest mm-hmm. effort, but there's a disconnect. The bureaucracy have forgotten to listen to the very consumers. The fact is that the Consumer Rail Council, which is now called the Transportation Council,
yeah.
with some very talented volunteers that have served, they weren't even consulted about this change in fares and schedule until it was released just earlier last week. How could you do that in not listening and respecting the very utilizers of this? So please, people, 3:30 on Thursday at the Stanford Transportation Center, people need to come and let them know how they feel. They can put down cards. If it's okay, Paul, I'd like to share
sure.
the direct email
yep.
that people can send directly that will be entered into official records of consideration. Mm-hmm. I put it all together into my website. It's Senator Huang, HWANG.com. We'll have the emails. We'll have all the schedules of the hearings and the details in which they can get involved. But
all
people
right.
need to have their voices heard because it seems like the pop-up is the only thing we're going to get in Fairfield County. And that, to me, is disappointing and disrespectful.
Maddening. Tony, thank you, and let us know what shakes out from this. We appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. Republican State Senator Tony Huang of Fairfield, not happy that a formal public hearing is not happening in Fairfield County. At the same time, there was or will be one in New Haven. There was or will be one in Hartford. Just to get people's opinions, the people that ride Metro North and the buses, by the way, too, every day to and through Fairfield County. And listen, as Tony said, obviously, there's still a big push here to try and sell Shoreline East or to save that line or the Hartford line, which of those trains you see if you're familiar with the New Haven to North Haven to Wallingford, Meriden, Middletown, Hartford corridor. And, you know, sadly, maybe it's, I don't know, maybe it's just a case of, well, guess what? You know, they and I don't know, I surely hope this is not the DOT's thinking on this, but maybe you have a scenario of some people that in you know, DOT headquarters maybe thinking, well, you know, yeah, we know a lot of people in Fairfield County use the trains, but hey, what's your alternative? And to a great point. That is true. If you want to email thoughts and questions on the proposed fare hikes and service cuts being proposed by Metro North, you can use the email dotproposedtransitchanges@ct.gov. You can do that. All right. And I guess from what I read, the biggest cuts are going to be in Friday service. Because I guess everybody is going to get cranked and get drunk on Thursday night and stay home Friday. Or work from home Friday in your jammies and slippers. How about that? Mike in Stratford. Mike, what's up?
Hey, Paul. Great to talk to you again.
Yes, sir.
A couple of quick buttons. Yes, it's no one's fault. MTA, the travelers, the commuters. Listen, I commuted to Stanford for years,
yeah.
Commuted up to Farmington. The average person can't commute because once they get to Stanford or walk, they can't get to Merritt 7.
Yeah.
It's too much. It's quicker to drive.
Yep.
So it's nobody's fault. And you got a lot of people working from home from now. So you don't need the train car. The parking lots are not full like they used to be. So something's got to give. But to Tony's point, they should have had a meeting in Fairfield County.
That's it.
That's the lion's share of the ridership.
Oh, my God. Yeah, at least, Mike, have the respect to say, here's what we propose. Do you agree with us or not? Absolutely.
Exactly. And Dianne Feinstein, I saw some things over the weekend.
Yeah.
A champion, just a stalwart of representing and being a female senator. She did so many things. At the end of the day, you don't want them dying in office.
No.
Fortunately, she did.
No.
But you and I spoke for months. You don't want them to get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
God rest her soul, she did a lot.
She did.
When I started to look at how she became mayor, she did a lot.
Yeah, and she worked across and she worked across the aisle too. She had a knack of knowing when to dig in her heels and when to be bipartisan. And sadly, I think that's missing a lot in D.C. now.
It is missing, and to Ruth Ginsburg, sometimes they're holding on to Susan Collins.
Yep.
They're holding on too long.
Yep.
I mean, some of these guys, too, it's a power trip. They're holding on too long, and I don't know what to really do.
Yeah, and Mike, thank you for the call, Mike. Appreciate it. In fact, to that point, there was an article, and Mike, if you're still listening, there was an article published, I think, in the Wall Street Journal, or it might have been in the Washington Post. They went back and interviewed these long-running senators who finally got out. Olympia Snow, Barbara Boxer in California, a couple of others who served like until they were almost 80, and they're like, they're all to a person, no matter what party. Thank God I left. Enough.